Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY, serving the Lehigh Valley. I'm John Pierce, your host, and working the board for us this evening is Neil Heaver, our operations director here at the station. In the next hour, you're going to find that my guest, Dr. James Bloom, who is a professor of English at Muhlenberg College, is an extremely interesting fellow with many interests, even outside of the discipline of English. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I try to keep my eyes open and ears open.
He's a former colleague, and because of his impeccable pronunciation of bonjour when he would see me, I affectionately call him Jacques. But his name really is James, and everybody calls you Jim except for me.
My brother calls me Frère Jacques.
he's a Francophile also.
Oh, all right.
Well, Jim Bloom started off his college days at Bennington College, Bachelor of Arts in Literature, and then moved on to the West Coast with the University of California, Santa Cruz. So you worked both coasts.
Yeah, but we don't like to talk about it too much.
And then you came right back to the East Coast for Rutgers,
right?
Which is your PhD in English, and is it a master in philosophy?
Yeah, that's kind of an intermediary step.
Going on toward the PhD.
Yeah.
And you have been at Muhlenberg College since 1982.
Right.
So that's a career right there. And what I'd like to do is, let's start off by talking about some of the books that you have published, because Jim Bloom has published 5 books over the past 30-some years, and he has a new one coming out next year. So let's talk about that one. It's called Reading the Male Gaze, and male is M-A-L-E. I remember when you mentioned this term male gaze to me a few weeks ago, and I said, what? And you said, oh, this is a term that's been around for a while. I looked it up, and it was 1975 that
right.
it was first
yeah.
being used. So what is this? What is the male gaze, and what's your interest in it, Jim?
Well, I probably should begin with a confession that I am a male gazer and have been for a long time, from even before the time when I heard the term or when the term was introduced in a very narrow academic field, in a burgeoning field of film studies, or what's become film studies, going back, as you said, to the 1970s. And it was very narrowly focused on the argument that most movies, certainly most Hollywood movies, are made for men and put men in the position of looking at women. And this scholar by the name of Laura Mulvey kind of argued that that was at the heart of the movie-going experience. Since then, since 1975, a lot has happened, and the term has become kind of ubiquitous, and it's been used a lot more loosely than I think Laura Mulvey first intended when she introduced it. She was focusing actually primarily on the films of Alfred Hitchcock at the time. And it's become, a term that people talk about in literary criticism and in movie reviews and in reviews of museum shows and art exhibitions. And it's used two ways. It's used, I think, very productively to describe an experience that's, widespread across the arts and across culture, because historically, most paintings and most movies, most novels are by men. And there's a kind of, I guess, a sort of heterosexual bias as well. So the kind of various practices that are involved in men looking at women kind of suffuse the arts over the several centuries, if
millennia.
Not millennia, right. Going back, say, to, David looking at Bathsheba or the judgment of Paris that set off the Trojan War. But it's also used more loosely and less usefully, I think, simply derogatorily, like, oh, that's the male gaze, as a way to discredit, deservedly discrediting leering and you know, kind of threatening gazing by men. So I'm kind of, you know, interested in the relationship between the way the term has been oversimplified and the much richer history that it has in the arts and in culture.
So the what do we do then if you're talking about most movies? Would you say that's still true today? That most of them are from a male point of view looking at women?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things I do, and I didn't certainly originate this, is to suggest that, first of all, when we recognize that, you know, there are also there are reasons to be interested in same-sex relationships, that the male gaze can also be simply among men. And also because the male gazer has become not so, you know, doesn't so much refer to a person as a way of seeing the world. And I've read, you know, women writers talking about this, you know, how women can kind of play the role of the male gazer. And more that's, I don't know whether that's new or it's being newly recognized among people who write about movies and novels and painting and poetry.
Women as male gazer sounds like an oxymoron. Does that mean that they're putting themselves in the position of looking at men?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's being recognized not simply as what a person does, but as a role someone can play. And I think there's a recognition of that, which is one of the things that makes the subject so interesting to me. Because I don't really write about real people. You know, I write about texts and images and roles. And so, you know, part of what I'm writing about has to do with the recognition of male gazing as a social and cultural practice and as a role that you can take on and take off, and not simply as something that real men do in real life, say when they're sitting in a movie theater or when they're standing in an airport or at a shopping mall looking at women.
What about I don't know if you'd call it a genre, but the term that we hear frequently, oh, that's a chick flick. Mm-hmm. Now, how does that fit into the male gaze? It would seem to for me to say, well, this is a movie that is basically going to appeal to women,
mm-hmm.
and it could involve almost certainly involves men in the story, but how does it fit in with the male gaze?
Well, I think that,
or does it?
Well, I don't know if it does. I mean, I certainly didn't make an argument that, you know, there's not a section in the book about the chick flick. I'm not sure I would use that term, even if I were talking about those movies. And I don't know if you think that's or if anyone thinks that's a derogatory term. You hear it all the time. But I worry, actually, that it is, so, you know, I don't use it.
Yes, well, I think it is a derogatory term.
Yeah.
Used mostly by men to say,
I don't want to go to that movie.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
Excellent. Is there a thread running through the work, or does each book project marking a new departure?
There is a thread, but I do think there have been, if you look at the titles and if anybody actually reads the books, they'll see that there's a kind of progression. Like many people in my field, as with many people in my field, the first book that I wrote came out of my dissertation. And that was very academic and very narrowly focused on the work and careers of two writers who were not very well known. One was better known than the other. That's the poet John Berryman, who in part became famous because he killed himself, prematurely. But I kind of, they were both academics to some extent and worked inside the academy. So it was kind of a rarefied subject and tailored to a very narrowly academic audience. The next book also paired two literary figures, but whose careers were much more worldly. Neither of them was an academic. They both were prominent, influential writers in the 1930s. And they were both communists, which at that time was a big deal, culturally speaking, because literature and the arts, when people talk about the literature and the arts of that decade, they often refer to it as the Red Decade. So one of the writers, especially a guy named Mike Gold, is still talked about. He wrote a very provocative and very popular book in 1930 called Jews Without Money. So in some ways there was continuity. I focused on the careers of two literary figures, a lot of close textual analysis. By the time I came to write my third book, I had already gotten tenure, so I was a lot freer to do what I wanted to do, but I was also very anxious about what I was doing. And I was teaching contemporary literature, and I got a lot of questions about, well, how do you decide what to teach? There's so many novels being written and so many short stories. And I didn't have a good answer to that question. So that third book, The Literary Bent, was actually my attempt to answer that question. You want me to go on to the next book?
Sure.
Or just got enough here? So with the next book, and you asked me about that first-year seminar that I taught that I wanted to call Funny Jews, and that the registrar changed to something like Jewish Humor.
Was that title changed? Now, the title that you wanted, and this is for first-year students in college, was Funny Jews.
Yeah.
And it was changed to Jewish Humor. Before you taught it, that they did not permit that to go into the catalog?
That never went onto the catalog. I guess there wasn't a website then. But
you and I talked a little bit about this off the air, and we think that the word Jews was what was upsetting to somebody.
Yeah, well, also I think that there was the adjective funny that some people, I think that that's a good thing, but some people think, you know, that it's funny weird or funny eccentric
instead
or funny
of comic.
Not quite right. You know, so that, of course, that's also been used as a euphemism for people you think aren't completely all there.
Yes.
You know, there's something funny about that guy.
Right.
So I think it was a combination. I was kind of offending two sensibilities.
All right. And how does this connect with the book?
Well, because that was also going to be the title of that book that the publisher changed, just as the registrar changed the course title. So, and by the time I, you know, was working on that book, not only was I tenured, but I was I had been fully promoted, so I could pretty much do whatever I wanted to do. I didn't even really have to publish at all by that point. But I kind of was able to step outside of, even farther outside of literature itself, and I realized there's a lot of connections and relationships between writers like, say, Philip Roth and entertainers like Woody Allen, for example. As well as even artists like the painter Larry Rivers, who was famous for that kind of pastiche painting of Washington crossing the Delaware. And so I wanted a way to sort of talk about all those figures in relationship to another. You know, also talk about stand-up comics like Lenny Bruce, Joan Rivers. So that's how I kind of stepped out of being a literary scholar and, into kind of a more participating
and
more broadly cultural conversation, which is what I probably wanted to do all along, but you couldn't major in that stuff or get degrees in that stuff, you know, when I was starting
out. And be respectable
out.
In the academic world.
Yeah, and I think it's a good thing because I come to it with a, you know, fairly traditional literary academic grounding, which I'm glad I have. So if they, if I've been able to do that, starting out, I probably wouldn't have had as much fun.
My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Dr. James Bloom, professor of English and American Studies at Muhlenberg College. That's still the title with the
I don't know if that's officially the title. I think at some point I started calling myself that, and then there became a rule that said if you want to have a dual title, you have to apply, and I don't think I ever got around to applying. So, sorry. I mean, I hope I'm not, like, you know, risking my job or anything.
Bureaucracy got in the way.
Yeah, yeah.
And he is talking about several books that he has written. The most recent of, well, the one that's upcoming that we're looking forward to seeing in print at some point, and that is Reading the Male Gaze. So, Jim, let's talk a little bit about how you got into the business of professing English in the first place.
Okay, well, that's I like to read. That's probably the short answer. It's probably the short answer.
Are you one of those folks who, when you were kicking the slats out of your cradle, had a book in your hand?
Probably not. I wasn't that smart or precocious, but
But you started at an early age.
Yeah, also I was youngest child, so I was really, I don't know if I can say this on the radio, but pissed off that all the other people around me were reading and writing. And, you know, there had to be something there. So, I assume.
You were encouraged by older siblings as a model for you.
Yeah, I don't know if they encouraged me because, you know, because I was a new kid on the block.
You were the annoying little brother, let's face it.
I had to go through a little hazing first. And of course, my parents were readers. They always had books on the night table and.
What was their occupation in life?
My father sold printing paper, and they had a family business that my grandfather and his brother-in-law founded after they got out of the sweatshops.
And this is in New Jersey.
It started out in Brooklyn in the Lower East Side, you know, working in the garment business. You know, I think both my grandparents on my father's side worked in the sweatshops. And then they saved enough money, and I guess there was kind of a little economic boom as World War I was winding down. So they settled in New Jersey and rented one floor of a warehouse and a wagon and started selling printing paper. And I guess the printing industry was booming. So my grandfather would just start out going from one printer to the next, I think on foot.
Were your grandparents immigrants to the U.S.?
Yes. On my father's side, both were immigrants, and on my mother's side, my grandfather was an immigrant.
Where did they come from?
Well, it's hard to say because a funny story is that one of my cousins did some genealogy research on my mother's side, and she looked at the census reports, and my mother's father, according to the 1910 census, was born in Austria, but according to the 1920 census, he was born in Poland. Because
with
the Habsburg Empire collapsed, and so it's hard to say where they came from. So, for example, I guess my grandfather was from the country that doesn't exist and perhaps may not exist much longer, called Ukraine. But of course, at that time, it was part of the Russian Empire. My grandmother is, I guess, from what's now Belarus. In the Russian Empire.
They presumably were both Russian-speaking.
Well, they spoke a lot of languages because you had to in that part of the world. So I think I once asked my grandmother, and I don't know how fluent she was in any of them, but she said, first of all, she had to go to night school to learn English. I think Yiddish was the language they spoke at home. Russian was the language that they spoke on the streets. And she actually, unusual for a girl in her circumstances, had some formal schooling. And I guess that was in Russian, and it was along the border with Poland. Now, as I understand, the spoken versions of Polish and Russian, even though the alphabets are different, they can often understand one another, when Polish speakers, Russian speakers, Ukraine speakers. So they were without much formal schooling, they were in some ways much better educated than I am or a lot of people are today, just because they had to be.
They had street smarts.
They had to be polyglots, yeah.
Yes. My guest this evening is Dr. James Bloom. I'm John Pierce. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY, serving the Lehigh Valley. Neil Heaver is our engineer this evening, and we're having a fascinating discussion about all kinds of things with Jim Bloom, who is professor of English at Muhlenberg College. Time to take a break. Stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Spread the word about your organization or business to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced music programs reaches thousands of locally engaged listeners each day. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable way to enhance your image and to provide information about your services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, call 610-694-8100, extension 6, or visit our website, wdiy.org.
We're back with Lehigh Valley Discourse. Dr. James Bloom is with me, and we're talking about all kinds of subjects. A little bit about his biography and really interesting background with the grandparents immigrating to the U.S. and starting off in Brooklyn and then moving to New Jersey eventually. And so you are a Jersey boy.
Yeah, I was born in Newark and grew up in the suburbs around Newark.
Mm-hmm. And then went to college at Bennington.
Well, first I started in New York City. I started at Columbia. And then in the turbulence of those years, decided I needed a change and moved to the country and finished up at
Bennington. Smaller place.
Yeah.
And then went way out to University of California, Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
And then back to the East Coast to Rutgers. So when it comes to sports teams, are you, do you follow Rutgers a lot?
No. I'm not a big sports fan. Played a few sports badly as a kid. There were no computers.
You have a lot of company in that.
Yeah.
Yes. So, Jim, we were talking about what got you into the business of and the profession of teaching English. What do you think pushed you toward that? You loved reading.
Yeah. Well, there are probably two reasons, if you can call them that. One is I knew I was going to have to make a living. And there weren't many things I was talented at. I told you I wasn't a very good athlete. I can't play an instrument. But I could read, and I saw that people got paid to read. So I knew I had to narrow my aspirations to one of those career paths. And English in particular, I realized, you know, I was probably not planning on being an English major when I started college. But as I started studying literature, and I don't really even think of what I do as English per se. I think of it as literature because I think it's kind of provincial and, you know, excludes a great deal of other literature that has fascinated me in various languages throughout history. But I realized that, as you know, people talk about the liberal arts, but I thought that in studying literature, I was getting all of liberal arts because if you read, you know, novels and poems, the novelists and poets and playwrights will draw on science and politics and history and music. You know, Thomas Mann's Dr. Faustus is about a composer, one of those novels that, not in English, that had a big influence on me. So it was a way of really educating myself as broadly and I might even say as promiscuously as I wanted to be educated. So it's kind of a catch-all area of study for me, not necessarily for everyone who does it. Some people are much more comfortable in much more focused kind of specialization, and that's fine. And I rely on the work by some of my fellow scholars who do that real spade work so that I don't have to, and I can pursue my interests more broadly and some might say more loosely.
Yes. The when you mention not being confined to the English language for books, in your courses, have you taught translations of works?
I do, but I'm very reluctant to do too much of that because even though I've studied a few languages and even can read a few languages, you know, you have to get a PhD, pass translation tests. Since I do insist on close analytical reading, once you get into translation, there's kind of a screen or a wall between me and the language, and then that kind of becomes more of a problem when I'm discussing the language with students, if it's a language I don't know. But, you know, I do occasionally break my own rule, so I'm teaching a play by Henrik Ibsen in my first year seminar this year, and I've taught Sophocles in another first year seminar. Usually I do it in courses that aren't English courses, but the first year seminars, which are supposed to be more of an introduction to ideas kind of class, so I feel a little bit easier about working with translations in those classes.
When you're teaching a course basically about ideas, some of the greatest ideas come from non-English.
Yes, right. Probably
texts,
all of them.
Right? As one of my professors said one time, the Greeks did everything, and then after them, after the ancient Greeks, everything else are footnotes.
Yeah, Well, I think that actually he stole that from the English philosopher Whitehead. He said all philosophy is a footnote to Plato.
Okay,
but that's a you know, nowadays that would be, you know, slammed as a kind of Eurocentric view. But
yes,
I'm not an expert on any of that.
The old traditional
there, yeah.
Jim, I'd like to ask you: do you have anything to say to the critics of higher education, critics of the so-called liberal arts, and especially the humanities, who insist that all that stuff is elitist and irrelevant.
Okay, well, one of the things that makes them relevant, you know, you said the critics of higher education, is that we can be critics of higher education, as I often am, and still be fully committed to it and fully engaged to it, which I think is one of the benefits of a liberal arts education, that you can be inside something and very passionate about it, but at the same time maintain a kind of critical distance on your own practices and your own assumptions. And I don't want to get all partisan, but I think nowadays, perhaps more than ever, that kind of dual consciousness is essential.
That's a very interesting point.
Yeah, and I would also say, as I was saying before about, you know, how I got into English, that if you want to, again, know a lot of things and be able to see the relationships among the various things that you know, the liberal arts aren't the only way you can do that, but I think, you know, they've been proven to be kind of the most disciplined way to go about that. I would also say it's simply not true that, you know, you can't get a job with a liberal arts education. You know, I think it was Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, am I allowed to mention politicians' names on the air?
Go ahead.
You know, claimed that, you know, you when he tried to defund the liberal arts in the Florida education system, that it's much better to be a welder than a philosopher. Of course, you can be a philosopher and a welder. I think he overlooked that. And in fact, you know, many of my, you know, colleagues in the arts, for example, who do work with their hands and do welding and carpentry as part of their work, are among the most, you know, as far as the liberal arts are concerned, among the most erudite and sophisticated people that I've encountered over the years. So there are a lot of examples, if you just talk to people and look at what people have done with the liberal arts, that become themselves the argument against that kind of reasoning.
Can you and I agree that not everybody, not every young person has the temperament or the patience or the smarts or whatever we might want to call it to go to college in a four-year program?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, and there are a lot of things that I don't have the temperament or the skills to pursue and do well.
Such as sports.
Okay. You know, pretty much anything that involves, you know, handling a tool, especially a power tool.
I'm with you on that.
Yeah, and you know, when I need to do that kind of stuff, I do it. I often do it poorly. Sometimes, actually, then have to go out and hire someone to fix what I screwed up.
Bravo for even trying.
Jack, yeah,
when you know that it's not your thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you know, so I don't think that, you know, there's any kind of superiority that comes with getting that kind of education. And I do understand that, you know, given the cost and given, you know, the limits on resources, both family resources and individual resources, as well as public resources, it can be considered a luxury. But I also think that if you think about, you know, the kind of social value that it can have, that's not the only way to think about it.
Yes. Social value and being a more interesting person when you mm-hmm. come out. When I think of myself as having stopped with a high school education, and I think what a difference that mm-hmm. the undergraduate years made for me particularly, I don't even want to think of what I would have missed mm-hmm. by not having that.
Well, let me play the devil's advocate on that point, okay? Because I have heard arguments, and you know, I know a lot of real smart people who never went to college. There's one argument that those years between, say, you know, 18 and 22 or whatever are going to be transformative almost no matter what you're doing. You know, so if you're in the Navy serving on an aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean or in the South China Sea and going to various ports, there's no guarantee that that's going to be a transformative education. Mm-hmm. But I think in many cases it has been. And can be.
It's an education in itself.
Yeah. So I do think there are many paths to maturity and enlightenment, and certainly the kind of education that I help offering isn't the only way.
I don't know how the term liberal arts was started, But we have a colleague, a former colleague, Nelvin Voss,
yeah.
who proposed...
He hired me, so he's the man to blame. Yeah.
All right.
he was chair of the English department, hired me. He was the dean when I got tenure, and he was already retired when I got promoted, so most of it is all his fault.
All right. Yeah. Well, let's hope he's listening right now.
Yeah.
But he said once upon a time, instead of calling it liberal arts, let's call it liberal education.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, liberal arts sounding as if you're talking about the traditional painting, sculpting,
yeah.
Theater, and so on, whereas the liberal education includes the hard sciences, mm-hmm. the social sciences, humanities.
Well, yeah, that speaks to an argument that I think a lot of academics have, and it's something that does irritate me, is that there are still people, you know, people much younger than I am, in academia, who think there are certain subjects that are the core liberal arts, and that other subjects, you know, are kind of
inferior,
less valuable, and some of it has to do with how long the subjects have been around, which is really not a good way to, you know, decide what's valuable and important. So, for example, I don't know, I had a colleague. Do you remember Fred Norling?
Sure.
Yeah. Fred Norling, who taught business, which is one of those subjects that some people, you know, disparage, some traditionalists in liberal arts disparage. But Fred was a real liberal arts guy. And the way he talked about business, the way he taught business, was right in the liberal arts tradition. You know, critical thinking, reading different kinds of sources and different kinds of material. So I think that any subject can be part of liberal arts, depending on the assumptions that one brings to it and the aspirations that one brings to one's teaching.
One of the alumni from Muhlenberg who was a basketball player, probably mediocre, Jack McCollum.
Oh, yeah, I did
and
work
he,
with Jack yeah,
did you?
Recently. On that Muhlenberg alumni magazine, I did an article on reading that Jack was a guest editor for.
He was a writer for Sports Illustrated for years, and he was the main NBA fellow for that.
Yeah.
And he taught a course at Muhlenberg for a couple of times, maybe more than a couple, called Sports, Society, and Media.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I'm mentioning it is it's exactly what you're saying about Fred Norling, and that is who, with a traditional mindset, would even think that you could have a course with sports in the title.
Uh-huh.
And yet, the way he did that course, and I sat in on it, was having the issue of race,
mm-hmm.
which is something that you have to contend with in sports.
And gender,
and
certainly.
All over gender and all over the spectrum of society.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked it into what he knows best, which are sports.
Mm-hmm.
And in a really... And
certainly economics is a central set of questions.
So in a liberal education kind of way.
Yeah.
It was really interesting. My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Dr. James Bloom, who is professor of English. He prefers really professor of literature at Muhlenberg College, or just plain professor.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that gives me kind of freedom to do whatever I'm going to do next rather than being tied to what I have been doing. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I'm getting a thread from our conversation that freedom to do is a real big item for you. Once you had tenure, now you were freer to do what you really wanted to do,
mm-hmm.
and you can only be looking forward to doing really whatever you want to do in retirement at some point.
I can't do anything else than what I'm doing now. So as I said, I have no talents except reading,
You're an old guy, and most old guys, like me, seem to enjoy complaining about these kids today. In fact, there was a song, Kids. What's the matter with kids today?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
What's the musical show? Neil knows.
Bye Bye Birdie.
Yeah, correct.
Conrad Birdie, yeah.
There you go. And so fretting about how the world is going to hell in a handbasket. So having taught now at least three generations of college, you've taught three generations of college students?
Yeah,
starting in the 70s, what is your take on kids today?
Well, this past semester, I taught both a senior seminar, what's called a, now they call it a culminating undergraduate experience, because you got to get the acronym in there. It's a Q course. And I also taught a course with a lot of freshmen in it, a contemporary fiction course. And that was great because it was, the contemporary fiction course was really mixed. We talk about diversity a lot, but there's a kind of diversity that we had in that class that we don't necessarily recognize, but it's very valuable. It had a mix of different class years. So there were freshmen in there, and I guess first-year students to seniors, all different majors, you know, pre-meds, theater majors, business majors, even an English major or two. And the I just read the papers for those courses, you know, the take-home exams, and I was so impressed with the work that these students did, and I was impressed with the conversations that they were able to conduct with me over the course of the semester. You know, they all, even the freshmen, seemed to come to college, you know, prepared with the basic writing skills that a lot of old fogies like to complain about. Kids today can't write, you know, they don't know the sentences.
They don't know cursive.
But also the sophistication of the thinking of many of these students. Certainly, you know, sometimes I shouldn't say this, but I wish there were people my age who could think as clearly and as subtly and be as observant as these students were. And certainly with this papers from the seniors, you know, not all of them, but a lot of those papers, you know, I would read and go, I wish I could have done this, you know, when I was a college senior. And some of that even, you know, with the lower class level work, I said, I can never have done this when I was 18 or 19. So I have no complaints. One thing I think that has changed is that, I mean, Neil maybe can speak to this as well, because he was at Muhlenberg then. But when I got to Muhlenberg, there were a few really off the charts, you know, smart achievers in my classes. But at the other end, there were a lot more, I don't know what the nice word is, it's probably not a nice word, louts, layabouts, people who, you know, were just trying to get by. But here, the kind of middle is much more impressive, much better prepared, much more conscientious, in some ways much more mature about doing their work and getting their work done. So I can't say I have no complaints, but I probably have fewer complaints about students now than I did back in 1982 and through the 1980s. So as far as I'm concerned, the change has been mostly for the good.
Yeah, sometimes we get the notion that it's just a slippery slope and mm-hmm. that students were excellent before and they sat there and they learned. And then now, and we know, of course, that when we look back 20 or 40 years or whatever, that it all looks rosier
we
today.
We do a lot of editing. As a former president of Muhlenberg once said in a conversation about grade inflation, he said, grade inflation began the day I graduated from college. Because, you know, when we talk about grade inflation, I also say, well, you know, we're borrowing a metaphor from either economists who talk about inflation in terms of currency, or from physicists who talk about all the inflation that's been continuous since the Big Bang 14 billion years ago. So I think this president was answering my question, well, if we're going to use the economic analogy, when did grade inflation begin? And he quipped,
as soon as I graduated.
Yeah, because I think economists have what they call a constant dollar year when they start measuring inflation, and that's their baseline.
Jim, we have to take another break now,
okay.
And we will be back in just 60 seconds.
Okay.
Stay with us here on Lehigh Valley Discourse.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Dr. James Bloom, professor of literature at Muhlenberg College, is attached to the English department, is talking about many interesting points about college education today. Jim, what would you tell a college student just starting out who expressed interest in doing the kind of work you do?
Well, I would warn them that it's very different. Inside higher education, a term that's become very widespread is the phrase contingent faculty. We used to simply call those colleagues adjuncts. But for budgetary reasons, perhaps, and perhaps more seriously, simply as a devaluing of higher education, colleges and universities are hiring people as kind of freelancers one semester at a time. So a much higher proportion of the jobs in academia, especially in the humanities and social sciences, are not really career path jobs.
They're part-time work.
Yeah.
So I would say
if you want to, be able to support a family, support yourself, that you probably should think twice. I would also say that, I said I got into this business, because I like to read and write. But I may not have had the kind of imagination that I needed to see that there were other ways to pursue those interests besides becoming an academic, besides becoming an English professor. So I would also suggest and encourage them to be a little bit more imaginative than I may have been, 40-some years ago.
Okay. The tough part is someone like you who loves the intellectual world is not good with manual kinds of work.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose you could have learned to do something manual if that had been your path of your life.
Yeah, I could have probably done it good enough, but not really, I could have been good enough, pardon my grammar, but I could never have done it well enough to really, excel at it. And I think, most people want to do something they think they can excel at. That also is a luxury, though. So my grandparents did manual work, and I probably have the same genetic makeup as they did. And they got by, milking the cow.
They did what they had to do.
Yeah, yeah. So, but that's one of the, it was John Adams who said that, he would study war so his son could study math, so his grandson could study the arts. And again, it's kind of elitist maybe, but that's one way that the progress of civilization itself has been measured. And even Marx said that, the idea would be people do their manual work during the day and get it done, and then they can cultivate the arts and their intellectual pursuits. But we come back to the question of when is doing that kind of work and pursuing those kinds of aspirations a luxury, and when is it something that we value enough to treat it as a necessity?
I used to tell students once in a while, do you realize what privilege it is for mm-hmm. you to be able to come to a college for 4 years and learn as much as you're learning when in other circumstances somewhere in the world this would be impossible for you.
Actually, I think nowadays a lot more students realize that, in part that's because of the cost and the sacrifices that a lot of families are making to make that possible.
You've mentioned the word families a couple of times, so let's give a shout-out to your wife and your son, and what's going on with them.
My son, as I said, as I told you before, is coming home today. He's a third-year law student, and he's already working as a lawyer a lot of the time, mostly doing immigration law. My wife was also an English professor. She retired early in order to start a business making beads for a while, and then sort of managing our lives became all-consuming, and it's quite a challenge to...
And where is your son studying law?
He's at Yale Law School.
And he will finish this year?
Yeah, in May.
And then he'll open up a practice somewhere?
No, he won't. He already has a job lined up in Chicago working for something called the... Community Activist Lawyer Alliance, again, continuing his work in labor law.
Who knows? Maybe he'll be working with one Barack Obama someday.
Yeah, maybe.
You have to go to see his house on the South Side.
Yeah, we saw it when we did our college shopping back in in the aughts, I guess.
Oh, listen, you're a lucky man, Jacques, because you get to go to Chicago to visit him.
In the winter.
In a while. Yeah. Well, let's get back to the subject of some articles that you wrote, and these are for the Morning Call. Mm-hmm. In the late 90s, you had almost a dozen op-ed pieces published in the Morning Call, but it's been almost a decade since one of your opinion pieces appeared. What has made you step back from the political arena?
Well, I guess, to be candid, in part the futility and the sense that that kind of writing wasn't having much impact. And I guess also, no offense to the Morning Call, but it's just a general tendency in the newspaper business that newspapers are less of a go-to forum for most citizens. And I did work in the presidential campaign back in 2008 because happily coincided with a sabbatical that I had that year. And I did find, at least when I was doing it, that that work kind of replaced the kind of civic engagement that I had been committed to as an op-ed writer. And, you know, there are just so many more opinion forums out there that I just guess think, I guess I think that writing op-eds for a daily newspaper in a small market doesn't have much impact.
We've talking about newspapers. The I lost my train of thought.
Oh, the reading the Times?
Yes.
Yes.
Your the course that you used to teach at Muhlenberg College called Reading the Times. Was it Reading the New York Times?
It was called Reading the Times, but sort of the snobbish implication was, you know, I guess people in London might, you know, have an even more snobbish assumption about what Reading the Times meant. And also it was a kind of a pun on reading the times we live in. And I think that it was Thoreau who said something like, why read the Times when you can read the eternities? So I think I had that in mind. Yes, I taught that first-year seminar back when Muhlenberg first instituted mandatory first-year seminars in the early 90s. And I think the last time I taught it was in 2008.
Why did you choose the New York Times?
Well, there's a selfish reason. Some of it had to do with when I became a parent back in the early 90s. I had much less time to myself, and one thing that I've kind of like religiously had always done was read the New York Times every day. So I had to figure out a way to incorporate it into my work routine so I wasn't, you know, didn't have to think I was sloughing off when I was just reading the newspaper. Also, more seriously, it speaks to what I said before about, you know, the liberal arts and my understanding of the liberal arts. Reading the daily New York Times, and even more so perhaps the Sunday New York Times, is in itself a kind of microcosm of a liberal arts education. You know, you got your business section, you got your sports section, you got your art section, you got your news section with international and national and local and political news. So if on Tuesdays, you know, there's a science section. Every day you're getting that liberal arts education simply by reading the New York Times, especially if you follow through and discuss what you've read, and in the case of this course, write about what you've read, and the students were in a position of, and that's not what I think is really central to liberal arts. If, as you read through the New York Times or any newspaper, you're making decisions about what's interesting to you and what's important. And some of that is based on, you know, the attitudes and biases and preferences that you already had. But in the course of reading through the New York Times, some of those assumptions and attitudes may come into question. So your sense of what's important and what you value may come into question.
You read other points of view.
Yeah, and even other subjects. Oh, I'm not, you know, I thought I was never interested in fashion, but the way this fashion article is written, is there something striking about it? So maybe I should be more interested in something that a lot of people think of as trivial and fluff. Like fashion. So one of the things that we did repeatedly in that course was students would have to come in and pick an article that they thought was one most worth reading in that particular day's times or from the day before and make an argument to their fellow students as to its importance. And I think one of the core values of liberal arts is enabling people to make those kinds of judgments and to look at evidence and information and do some reflection and analysis and make an argument for what's important. When I was kind of a little disaffected with graduate school back in the 70s, I took the Foreign Service exam, and I passed the written test, and they invited me down to Washington for this exercise that they gave you. They gave me an inbox full of memos, and you had to sort them out and organize them and then come into a room and say why this project that you may not have even known this kind of project existed before is worth a budgetary consideration and perhaps State Department funding. So that was very, even though, you know, it turns out I didn't end up becoming a diplomat or a CIA agent or whatever I would have ended up being. That was a very useful exercise for me, and I think it's informed my teaching a lot since then.
And part of that kind of thing, because I did the same thing. I went for that exam, mm-hmm. made it through the first part, mm-hmm. but did not make it through the oral part.
Yeah, that was the oral part.
And the downfall for me was economics. I had no background in it, and I just couldn't answer uh-huh. questions well enough. But one of the points of I think, of the diplomatic service is being able to write concisely, mm-hmm. even maybe bullet points. Mm-hmm. Something to catch the supervisor's eye, because he's looking over
right.
hundreds of these all the time, and trying to get your point across. And that's a useful exercise.
Yeah, and that goes back to your question about the op-eds. I did enjoy writing them because, unlike a lot of people who do what I do, when I write, you know, a lot of what I'm writing is necessarily academic, but I've always had a hand in doing non-academic writing for a general audience. So I used to write for a magazine, Neil probably remembers, it's called Cream, which was a rock and roll magazine. I did reviews for that. I did book reviews for the Philadelphia Inquirer and even a few short reviews for the New York Times Book Review. And recently you mentioned Jack McCallum. He had me do an article for the Alumni Magazine, which again is pitched to a very different audience than the academic audience. So I really value that I get to do that kind of non-academic writing, as well as the more polysyllabic, complex, sometimes pretentious writing
yes.
That I've needed to do in order to become a successful academic.
Do you attend national meetings of the Modern Language Association?
The last time I went to an MLA meeting was, I think, in 2011 or 2012 in Los Angeles. And I tend to go, I do go to other academic conferences, you know, sort of smaller groups. Like I write a lot about F. Scott Fitzgerald, so I went to a conference in Ireland. Even though the funny thing is, Fitzgerald had no interest, despite his last name, in being Irish or never went to Ireland. And I'm going to one in Minnesota, which is really the Fitzgerald mecca. So I do occasionally go to conferences, in part just to keep my hand in. And usually to build on some work that I'm already doing. But I don't do that as much as I used to because I don't have to, because I'm not as enthusiastic about waiting around airports and going through security and trying to find a parking space and as I used to be.
Yes, I hear you. Well, Jim Bloom, you have lived in the Lehigh Valley most of your life now. Once upon a time, we asked a very old woman out in Colorado who was in a tiny mining or former mining mm-hmm. town. She was the postmistress and she was the school marm and she did everything. And we asked her, Annie, have you lived your whole life here?
She said, not yet.
That's exactly what she said. Yeah. Oh, you met Annie too.
Oh, yeah. We went out together.
So you've lived on both coasts. Mm-hmm. What's the one thing that you would change about the Lehigh Valley if you were czar of the Lehigh Valley?
One phrase, a passenger train to yes. New York and Philadelphia okay. and Newark Airport. I said before, I don't like to travel as much as I used to. I might like it a little more if I could get in and out of here easily. And I will say that it's much better than when I moved here before I-78 was completed. And you just used to live on Route 22 if you're trying to go anywhere. Route 22 is still not paradise, but you rarely have, unless there's a bad accident, you rarely have those kinds of just you know you're going to be here, and you never know, you don't know if you're ever going to get off, kind of afternoons and mornings.
I think you and I would agree that if we had six lanes on Route 22 instead of four, it would be a big improvement.
Yeah, but we would fill it up just as,
That's true. And more and more trucks.
Yeah, but I think the train would be, just right through from, I know they're building, they're consolidating the Transbridge bus terminal at the airport. So if they just put in a train line, straight through to Newark Airport, right into Manhattan, and then going the other way, straight into 30th Street Station, it would be a lot better. I don't know if you've ever taken the Bieber bus to Philadelphia, but that's a real slog. They like stop at every town along the way, Quaker Town.
On the other hand, their bus Silasville. From West Coastville to New York City is nonstop.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's interesting that they do it.
Yeah, sometimes they stop at Hellertown, I guess. Yeah.
Jim, besides the book that you're working on now, and we should mention again, it's called Reading the Male Gaze.
Yeah, actually, I think the title, it might be Reading the Male Gaze in Literature and Culture. We're still discussing that with the publisher.
All right. And do you have any guess as to when that might come out into publication?
Probably scheduled for next year, but I don't know. The publisher's in London, and they'll send me some questions and suggestions. I'll take care of them, and I won't hear from them for months. So
we'd hope by 2018 anyway, it would be out. Okay. And is there any other project that you're working on besides the book?
I am set up for supposed to have a sabbatical about a year from now. And I'm thinking of revisiting some work that I did earlier. So I mentioned my second book, Left Letters, where I wrote about Mike Gold and Joseph Freeman. One of the things that I had hoped would happen in the wake of that book, when there was a kind of community of scholars focusing on that subject, was that someone would write a thorough but accessible biography of Mike Gold, who was a fascinating character. But no one has, so I'm thinking maybe I need to step up to the plate and do that. Also, I've written a lot about the novelist Philip Roth, and I've become, especially in the wake of these two recent movie adaptations of his novels, Indignation and American Pastoral, I've become very narrowly focused on Roth as someone who writes about World War II and its aftermath and sort of subsequent American wars that grew out of World War II and the Cold War. He wrote about the Korean War and Indignation and the Vietnam War and American Pastoral.
So he's one of your major interests.
Yeah, and I've written a lot about him, so I'm thinking of revisiting some of that as well.
Guess what? Our time is up.
Oh, well.
This is
time
it.
Time flies when you're having fun.
That's it.
Tempus fugit.
This is Tempus fugit. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce. Our engineer this evening, Neil Heaver, has carried us through another version of Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we appreciate that. We thank you, listeners, for tuning in. And until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.